Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to find out about how vitamins can reduce your risk of skin cancer and how cinnamon actually helps you as good as any pharmaceutical drug for menstrual pain, but with no side effects. Are you treating your heartburn for a heart attack? You may be. And conquer drug-resistant superbugs, you know, the really bad ones like MRSA, with natural essential oils and traditional medicine. It's all validated by good science. That and much more on today's health report. Then we're going to look at some of the issues today that don't get some attention. I believe they should. We've been talking for some time about the 1%. And clearly, as a metaphor, it's good. It gets people's attention. It galvanizes some thought. But it's all a lie. It's a fraud. It's an embarrassment to anyone that actually wants to know the truth. So today, I'm going to challenge the 1%, 99% as being a complete, total myth. And instead, deal with income inequality, oligarchs, sociopaths, power-hungry people, indifferent people, hardworking people, decent people. We don't have one society. We don't have one industry. We don't have one set of finances. We don't have one economy. We have multiple. I think we had better stop for a moment in time and regain some sense of objectivity instead of this monotheistic way that we're dealing with everything and solving nothing. So today, but I'm going to do it in a little unusual way. We're going to take a look at the mildly rich people. Mildly rich. Well, you see them all the time. You just not be aware that they have problems. Serious problems. No matter how rich they are, they're just not rich enough. They're not billionaires. They're not 500 million to a billion. They're not even 100 million to 500 million. No, they're unfortunately in that group of people who just, well, shed a tear. They're from $1 million to $100 million. And hey, when you want to get into a private school for the ultra wealthy, and because they're having everything done more opulently, and your kid just needs that, you don't want to feel left behind, do you? So today, we're going to look at the rich but not ultra-rich, and not super-rich, but not rich enough, therefore depressed and anxious. And guess how much their kids pay to go to school each year? Now, I'm not talking about college kids, graduates. I'm talking about young kids, 10-year-olds, $40,000 a year, and growing, $45,000 in New York City. What are they getting for it, and how does that impact the rest of society? Also today, from Media Benjamin, 10 steps to wean U.S. foreign policy off militarism. I took a look at it. I think it's worth sharing with you. And also today, who are the real biggest killers in America? From Zaid Chinali, from Alternet. Think again, and we're going to open this call up when I for calls after I discuss it. Who are the biggest killers in America? It'll surprise you. And then a former Defense Intelligence Agency chief, meaning the top man in intelligence in the United States, he says, on the record, and I'll quote him, the United States created the rise of the Islamic State, quote, it was a willful decision, end quote. Wow. Brad Hoff, Information Clearinghouse, has that. We'll share it with you. Fukushima, trillions of becquerels of radioactive material still flowing every 24 hours into the sea. It's now circulating around the globe with devastating consequences. Why aren't we doing a thing about it? And we're doing nothing about it. Time permitting, we'll also today hear from a U.S. journalist, a really respected journalist, who found out that the U.S. government bugged her computer. Yeah, and also did a lot worse than that. They planted documents that would discredit her. CBS News, Cheryl Atkinson, details how her life was affected when she started talking about the truth of things. So we'll look at that. Also today, I want to take a look at the surprisingly dramatic role of nutrition in mental health. We'll deal with that. So you see, we are loaded with good things and empowering information. Let's begin. We know that vitamins are important when we go outside in the sun, especially the antioxidants, for a simple reason. When the sun hits your skin, there's a whole lot of reactive oxygen species or free radicals that are created. One of the things a free radical scavenger can do, and a scavenger would be vitamin E, vitamin C, coenzyme Q10, for example, they will grab onto it and neutralize it. Hence, the more vitamin C you have before you go into the sun, the more of those free radicals that would be lighting up your skin as sunburn will be diminished, and therefore less damage to the tissue and less likelihood of having a precancerous or cancer lesion later on develop from that sun exposure, usually years afterwards. So when you come back in from the sun, you should also have those same vitamins all over again. It's like a double positive, you know, potency for the skin. But that's just what my own observations have been. Also, skin cancer in all forms is the most frequently diagnosed kind of cancer, both in the United States and abroad. And while some forms of this condition are easily treatable and have a good prognosis, others like melanoma, well, that will kill you. It's very deadly. And mostly due to the fact that it can spread easily to other parts of the body. And so historically, we were told, go get your sunscreen in that and wear protective clothing and hats and other measures to avoid ultraviolet exposure to the sun that can lead to skin cancer. And then their artificial tanning beds with their intense ultraviolet rays have also been criticized as unhealthy. However, recent research has found that high levels of certain vitamins can reduce the risk of developing skin cancer. Now, at the top of the list is vitamin D. Now, we know we need it. It's one of these wonderful nutrients that helps almost every one of the systems in our body. Well, when sunlight hits your skin, the reaction occurs which activates vitamin D and allows it to be used easily by the body. And researchers have found that adequate vitamin D in the body not only reduces the risk of melanoma, the most serious form of skin cancer, but other cancers as well. And that doesn't mean that you should run around in the sun without any protection or that you can use tanning beds, which I don't believe people should use at all. It just means that always make sure you have more than adequate levels of vitamin D, and that will help additionally protect your skin. Vitamin C protects your skin. Bioflavonoids and quercetin are protective. And recent research coming out of Australia found that vitamin B3 can also help to reduce the risk of skin cancer. And in one study, 386 patients with a history of either basal or squamous cell carcinoma, a common but less serious forms of skin cancer, they were given 1,000 milligrams of vitamin B3 or a placebo daily. And at the end of the study, those who had taken the B3 were 23% reduced risk of developing cancer. So that's pretty good. And always make sure you get a non-flush B3. Millions of Americans have indigestion. You've all seen the commercial with the food smacking the person, or all kinds of problems when a person wants to eat their favorite food. Well, of course, the smart thing would be to not eat the food that offends you. But that's not how we deal with things. We don't deal with the cause. We deal with the symptoms. So kill the acid condition. So now there's a new study that finds that these acid-blocking drugs will work. It'll calm heartburn, but it can give you a heart attack, even death. That's correct. According to the last study just out on acid reflux, and people saying, we got to fix it, we got to fix it, and they'll give them drugs like Nexium and Prilosec, but there's a negative effect, the heart. Researchers from Stanford University showed that proton pump inhibitors, PPIs, are linked to higher risk of myocardial infarction and death, even among people without heart disease. Now, just so you understand, the PPIs block acid production in the stomach to reduce or eliminate heartburn. They're prescribed primarily for gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD. According to the Stanford researchers, PPIs are among the most widely used drugs in the world, with over 113 million prescriptions filled globally every year. Add to that the over-the-counter versions of the drugs, and it's a $13 billion a year industry. Wow. If people only ate sensibly, quietly, not overate and didn't miscombine their foods, not all these junk and soda with a meal, we wouldn't have any of this. In the U.S. alone, about 21 million people use the PPIs, but they've been called one of the most dangerous and overprescribed medications on the market. The Stanford study, published on the journal PLOS ONE, found that people taking PPIs were up to 21% more likely to suffer a heart attack and 122% more likely to die of cardiovascular disease. Wow. The researchers reviewed health data containing 16 million electronic records on 2.9 million patients. That's a lot of research from 1994-2011. So, there you have it. If you suffer from acid reflux, don't use the over-the-counter or prescription drugs to diminish acidity. Simply get rid of the things that you're doing. Like coffee is one of the most common causes of GERD. Behind that are the sodas that you drink. Drinking with a meal. You shouldn't be drinking with a meal. It dilutes the acid. Then the stomach has to create more acid, and you dilute it with the next drink, and the stomach has to create more. You dilute it, etc. And then it all dumps into the intestine. And the backlash is regurgitation and up into the hydrochloric acid and the sensitive mucous membranes of the esophagus. Just stop doing it. And then you don't end up dying of a heart attack from, or having a heart attack from, the medication. We are a country that has faulting immune systems. We have an aging population, and we have a lot of sick younger people in our population. Both are caught into this matrix of suffering where we used to cut ourselves, you know, scrape a knee, cut something. Well, it healed. Well, today what happens is we end up with superbugs, especially in hospitals. How big is it? Well, we could be spending at least $1 billion a year in antibiotics just to fight the bugs that we have that are superbugs. What about natural approaches? Okay, here are some proven, natural, scientifically based oils that can help with superbugs. Right up at the top of the list is oil of oregano. Oil of oregano is called nature's antibiotic. It contains two very powerful natural antibacterial oils and substances called, one is called carvacrol, and the other is called thymol, and they can kill fungus, they can kill bacteria, they can kill yeast, and that's terrific. So if you have Candida albicans, Aspergillus, mold, Staphylococcus, Klebsiella, E. coli, Giardia, Pseudomonas, Salmonella, Listeria, it can kill it. So that is good. Tea tree oil, it's a long history of medical use. The Aborigines in Australia used tea tree leaves. They would wrap them in a poultice around skin infections and wounds and snake and insect bites and burns by crushing the plant and make it into a poultice. Well, we now see from the scientific literature, yeah, you can treat staph infections and wounds. Also, clary sage. Clary, C-L-A-R-Y. Sage, S-A-G-E. The oil of the clary sage is really good. And there was a good study I recently read where it destroys Staphylococcus aureus. And the scientists believe that the results were significant enough that it should be used in formulations to kill. And they can soak the bandages that are put on so that the clary sage is able to stay in contact with the wound. Cinnamon bark oil and cinnamon leaf oil have been used medically for 1,000 years. There's some scientists at Kansas City State University found that cinnamon acts as a natural antibiotic, and it's a great boost to the immune system due to the high amount of antioxidant it contains. It also has strong antimicrobial properties. In fact, the American Journal of Chinese Medicine boasts that cinnamon's essential oil can combat the common cold. Rosemary can kill over 60 strains of E. coli that were in hospital patients. Thyme, T-H-Y-M-E, the leaf and the oil are effective as natural antibiotics. So these are things that are extremely effective, they're extremely safe, easy to find, and inexpensive. And speaking about cinnamon, a good study, a randomized double-blind trial of 114 female college students received either 420 milligrams of cinnamon, that's a small amount, very small amount, that's about one tenth of a teaspoon, or 400 milligrams of ibuprofen, or placebo, three times a day for the first 3 days of menstruation. And there was no benefit of the ibuprofen over the cinnamon, but there were over the placebo, which meant that cinnamon is as good as the drugs. And for 16 hours onward, pain scores for the cinnamon group were 2 points lower than the other group. And that is important. So if you're having PMS symptoms, there are many things you could do that would help for pain, like more magnesium from citrate, 1,200 milligrams, also B6 at 50 milligrams, evening primrose oil. These are all very good for pain. But taking cinnamon by itself also is good as well. And from Harvard University, hello to all the vegetarians in the audience. Red meat is off the table. Okay, according to the latest study, because it increases the risk of colorectal cancer. We've been saying that for a long time. This was a study. Researchers at Loma Linda University analyzed the dietary habits of more than 70,000 people. Those who were vegetarian had a 22% lower risk of colorectal cancer than those who weren't vegetarian. And among those who ate a vegetarian diet that included fish, the reduction was 43%. Now that's interesting. And a person that is vegetarian but eats fish is called a PESCO vegetarian, P-E-S-C-O, and or a part of the PESCO diet. So you doubled your protection from colorectal cancer if you included fish. And so all that's important, and it was also published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine. Now, we know that there are a lot of things that you could do to reduce your risk much further. And with all the different supplements and all the juices that can protect your colon from cancer. But I'm glad to see that just the diet alone and getting rid of the red meat made a big difference in the processed meats in particular. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on our nutrition. Now a few things from the environment. And let's start with something that is out of our mind right now, and that's Fukushima. There has not been a single thing that has changed from day one of the meltdown and the release of all that radioactive materials into the subsurface, which melted right through and now went into the aquifers. And those aquifers in Japan are what they use to irrigate their fields with, which grows their rice. Therefore, they're using radiated water. Plus, it was being spilled out into the ocean. There's an old notion that is not true by measure. It is this, that the answer to pollution is dilution, meaning the more something is diluted, the less toxic it is. Well, by measure, that is true, but with radioactivity, it is not, because that radioactivity, especially plutonium, will be there forever. And so they can't say that. With other things, yes. You know, in time, diluted, it will go away. Not with radiation. And then you say, okay, but look at the ocean. The ocean takes up 77% of the entire planet. Well, that's approximately true, minus about 2%. But it is still there and growing every 24 hours, over 100,000 gallons, nonstop. Now, it's been years, every day, of polluting. This is from Energy News, from journalist Maury Robinson of the Center for Remembering. Quote, I begin with the radiation leakage. Radiation leakage experts say that long-term effects on the environment will contaminate our food chain, the groundwater, and the ocean. And the contaminated seawater will circulate around the globe. We never know how much this will impact our environment. We'll never be able to study such an issue with empirical certainty due to nuclear testing. We have already accumulated hidden losses of radiation damage. How much is the Fukushima cesium in relation to that? I believe we should enjoy delicious food rather than worrying about the food. I enjoy the town's delicacies. I didn't mind about how the beef was produced or where it came from, as long as it was tasty. It is no problem for me. With regard to the radiation, I've become more optimistic. My hypothesis is that it's no use worrying about radiation. For people in Fukushima, they have a lot to worry about their future, like damaging reputation. So that's one person's perspective. And I think it's completely nuts. To say you do not care about where your food comes from, as long as it's tasty, well, why don't you watch the reactions on a group of faces?
Throw at least one away.
we will not be able to deal with Fukushima because our waters will be so polluted, completely polluted. You won't be able to, at some point, eat anything out of the Pacific Ocean, at any level of the Pacific Ocean. You'll also find that it'll be too dangerous to go into the waters and swim or surf in Hawaii. Yeah, and the Philippines. That's coming. Remember, the water doesn't stop flowing and carrying its contaminants because we feel uncomfortable with the consequences of knowing the truth of our actions. Also, on the environment, this is from Reynard Loki. In June, the Grand Canyon was named one of the most endangered places in America by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. But the designation came just 2 months too late to possibly influence U.S. District Judge David Campbell. In April, he denied a request by an Indian tribe and a coalition of conservation groups to halt new uranium mining next to the Grand Canyon National Park. How close is this major uranium mining? 6 miles from the Grand Canyon's southern rim. Quote, "We were very disappointed with the ruling of Judge Campbell in the Canyon Mine case," said one of the tribe leaders. "We believe that the National Historic Preservation Act requires the Forest Service to consult with us and other affiliated tribes before they let the mining company damage Red Butte, one of our most sacred traditional cultural properties." The tribe has joined the coalition of conservation groups to challenge this. The bottom line is that with this administration and the last, if you're powerful, if you've given campaign contributions, if you're part of one of the Washington consensus, you can do just about anything you want, anywhere you want, and you will have the government's backing. But if you're doing something on native land, even sacred burial land, not to worry, the Department of Interior has never been a friend, always been an enemy, always an enemy of the Native American. I wrote a whole book on it, Stopping the All-American Genocide Machine. What a despicable organization. But then again, in my opinion, most agencies of government are despicable. Cancers. And it's amazing how some groups and some ideologies think, isn't it just great? Look at this cancer growing. We love this cancer. It looks after us. Does it? Please tell me how. And when it grows into some monstrous bureaucracy that only serves its own interest and those who are powerful enough to control it, and you start to complain that, gee whiz, why are they doing this to us? And why aren't they responsible? And why is there no transparency? Well, because you thought that it was better than what it was. In fact, starting in the near future, I'm going to be sponsoring a radio program of a foundation that looks at every government agency and tells you the truth from the government's own inspector general's reports, how incompetent and corrupt it is, the cronyism, and how each of these agencies are used by special interest groups, Department of Interior, the Nuclear Regulatory Agency, the Defense Department. They're all corrupt. All of them, top to bottom, the IRS. So you want to befriend them, do so at your own peril. For the rest of us, we want to see the truth and bring them to a size and level that they serve the American public and don't try to intimidate it. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. This is from Media Benjamin, 10 Steps to Wean U.S. Foreign Policy Off Militarism. 1. Reduce military spending. Build a peace economy. I agree with that. We're currently all told, on and off the books, spending $1.5 trillion. But here is the question. How much money do we need to legitimately be able to defend ourselves? About $100 to $200 billion a year. Everything else is profiteering by special corporations, no-bid contracts, bloated bureaucracies, redundancy, and corruption. So there's $1.4 trillion saved. And number 2, expand the U.S. use of diplomacy. Yes and no. I would get away with all diplomats. I would fire every diplomat. We haven't had a good diplomat I know of. Because how do you become a diplomat? It's simple. Those who give the most get inside of circles, and from those circles, the payback is you get a diplomatic position. But what if you're not aware of anything other than how you earned your money? And most, that's it. Why not get people who have experience in the field, who are not ideologues, who have no political affiliation as such, and simply have positive solutions for diplomatic crisis? That's where our diplomacy should come from. Number 3, abide by international law. No unauthorized wars. I agree with that. I think media is right on that. I would go one step further. I would insist the United States adhere to the International Criminal Court, which it is not a member of, but also all things historically that we have done that have violated the Nuremberg Convention, which we are a signatory to, that we should be held accountable for, which means that we should have probably in the neighborhood of 10,000 to 20,000 lawyers, and I would select some of the most seasoned lawyers who are academics, not practicing attorneys, but people who are constitutionalists, and go after every one of the people in any administration that broke the law and hold them accountable with people's courts so that everybody would be held accountable instead of Barack Obama saying, well, that's yesterday and let's forget about that. No, it's not yesterday. Crimes against humanity do not have an expiration date. There is no statute of limitations for crimes against humanity. Hence George Bush, Bill Clinton, all the presidents, all the cabinets, all the people who participated should be held accountable. I also believe that to give them a chance, give everyone a chance, give everyone a get-out-of-jail card free. How would I do it? I would do a truth and reconciliation. If you come forward and you tell us the truth and you show us the truth about your misdeeds, then you don't go to jail. The public then has an opportunity to say, okay, at least we know things we didn't know. At least we know the truth of all these false flag operations. We know they're false flag. And we know all the times you conspired and the deals you made. And you have to tell us everything. If you hold back anything, you do go to jail for life. All right? And then don't send them to a jail in the United States. That would be way too kind. If you've committed a crime against humanity, let's send them to a jail someplace else. All right? Maybe in Iceland, where they've only had one killing by a cop in their entire history, and that was this year, and they don't carry guns. And but their jail wouldn't have the geothermal heating. So, number 4, work towards a nuclear-free peace. That would be a good idea, but the entire policy, the capstone of Obama's environmental policy is to create a clean nuclear energy. Well, he also came into office promising clean coal, and neither are possible.
It's a shame.
I'm going to have some new stuff to share about her next week. Close overseas military bases? You bet. That saves us over $100 billion a year and 800 bases, and we're no longer meddling in other countries' affairs. Observe U.S. law prohibiting the sale of weapons to human rights violators. Media, why not prohibit all weapon sales to all people? Period. No more making landmines, no more making any weapons that be sold to any country, no regime, not Egypt or anyone else, not Saudi Arabia, no one. Get out of the business of it. In the militarization of police departments, yep, and stop illegal detention of prisoners in Guantanamo and elsewhere, I agree, and respect whistleblowers and our privacy. Well, that means they would have to take down, which they should, the National Security Agency, the CIA, the Homeland Security, and they should. Those should all be abolished, and all those employees and former directors should go to work at Walmart or someplace else, where a lot of hardworking Americans who are more honest actually work, and let them see what it is instead of listening in vicariously to other people's conversations, which they don't need to do because the average American doesn't intend to go out and do something of a terrorist act tomorrow. Yet you treat every single person as if they were terrorist. Man, oh man. Thank you, Media Benjamin, for your 10 points. And finally, before we go to a clip here, this is from Al Jazeera's television program called Head to Head. The former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Michael Flynn, said the following about a memo, a Defense Intelligence Agency memo, predicting the West's backing of an Islamic State in Syria when it came across his desk in 2012, but even asserts that the White House is sponsoring of radical jihadists that would emerge as ISIL and Nusra against Syria's regime was, quote, a willful decision, end quote. Now, here's what's surprising. Flynn, according to Brad Hoff, actually took issue with the way the interviewer, Mehdi Hassan, posed the question. Flynn seemed to want to make it clear that the policies that led to the rise of ISIL were not merely the result of ignorance or looking the other way, but the result of conscious decision-making. Here's the conversation, so listen carefully. This is verbatim. Quote, Hassan, you're basically saying that even in government at the time, you knew these groups were around. You saw this analysis and you were arguing against it. But who wasn't listening? Flynn. I think the administration. Hassan. So the administration turned a blind eye to your analysis. Flynn. I don't know that they turned a blind eye. I think it was a decision. I think it was a willful decision. Hassan. A willful decision to support an insurgency that had the Salafists, Al-Qaeda, and the Muslim Brotherhood? Flynn. It was a willful decision to do what they're doing. And even Hassan himself expressed surprise at Flynn's frankness during that portion of the program while holding a paper copy of the 2012 DEIA report classified through the Freedom of Information Act, or declassified. He read it out loud, key passages. Quote, is there the possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria? And this is exactly what the supporting powers in the opposition want in order to isolate the Syrian regime, end quote. Rather than downplaying the importance of the document and these startling passages, as did the State Department, soon after its release, Flynn does just the opposite. He confirms that while he was the top person in America in intelligence analysis, he was the DIA chief, he said, close, he paid, quote, very close attention to this report in particular, and then adds later that the intelligence was very clear. So, Lieutenant General Flynn, speaking safely from retirement, is the highest-ranking intelligence official to go on the record saying the United States and other state sponsors of rebels in Syria knowingly gave political backing and shipping weapons to Al-Qaeda in order to put pressure on the regime in Syria. So we, the United States, with full knowledge, we supported the Salafists, the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, Islam's worst of the worst, the Islamic extremists in ISIL. We were behind it all. Without us, it couldn't have happened. So we created the terrorists. That's the bottom takeaway line. And we actually had someone who ran the entire operation, not an underling. He was a top person. Acknowledge it. How about that? Your thoughts. Talk back. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888 on any of the issues I've addressed today. And before we go to our a little break here for an audio clip of Cheryl Atkinson from ABC, I thought you'd find this interesting. Mildly rich people's problems. The mildly rich. Private schools for the ultra-wealthy keep getting more opulent. Is it a problem if the somewhat wealthy feel left out? Helene Olin. And then she goes on to talk about how in Los Angeles and New York City, there's schools. Now, we're not talking about high schools or colleges, regular schools that you and I would have maybe paid $20 to go to. They're $45,000. All right? But it's not good enough. Now, the parents who are wealthy or the really wealthy, they want to have more for their kids, everything for their kids. And by the way, these are the same parents who send their kids to camps, but the camps have to bring in and are competing with world-class chefs to make gourmet meals, and they don't have log cabins. When I went to 4-H, I went up to Life Scout, One Below Eagle. I was a scoutmaster, and we went to scouts, and we would build mud ovens, and we would look at herbs, and we would do all these things. They don't do any of that today. They have to have ultra luxury. They are even where we would have, you know, our parents would have taken us in a pickup truck or a car to scout camp for a week or two. Not today. And, you know, we slept in tents, and it rained, you got wet. Not today. Today, the not-so-wealthy will take a bus. And it's a 45-minute above New York City. It's a bus ride to the camp. All right. But if you're wealthy, you can't be seen on a bus with almost wealthy people or less wealthy people. You have to be taken by a chauffeur to a private airport where you get on daddy's little jet and you're flown to an airport that's an hour and 20 minutes from the camp. But at least you'll be known as the kid that flew to camp, summer camp, on a private jet. The total cost for the limo ride, the private jet, and the ride from the jet to the camp, all told, it's about $25,000. A bus, it's $50. But again, these are all rich kids. It's just that, darn it, you know, the almost richer than anyone else are really having a rough time of it. Because now, no matter what you give them, there's always someone who's giving more. So now they're out competing with what they do for their kids. Of course, no one's ever asking, are these kids worth it, or are they just the next generation of spoiled, petulant, narcissistic brats who don't give a damn about anyone in the world except themselves because they're poor, spoiled, rotten to the core parents, and because of the parents' friends and families, and because of the people they work with and the entire industry that they have created, and everybody being a suck-up to greed. No one asks that question. Spend an hour with any of these people, anytime, any place, and you'll get an idea what I'm talking about. But that's not what I care about today. I want to challenge this whole notion, I'm really tired of it, of 1%, 1%. Well, that came out of the Occupy movement, and that was a good thing because it at least drew attention to the fact that there was disparity. Absolutely support that. But then some people forget that it was only meant as a very broad-based, loosely held notion of an analogy, analyzing the difference between groups. So let's try to put this in a little better perspective. There is no 1% and 99%. There's only all of us. Now think of it this way. Deconstruct the argument. When you put your money in their bank, and they're the chief holders of stock in that bank, and they control the board of directors, then you're making sure that your savings, your retirement funds, your pensions are managed or controlled by them. When you buy their clothes made at cheap labor in Bangladesh, you're supporting them. When you watch their television, you go to their ball games, you pay for their pay-per-view channels, you pay for their DirecTV or their Dish or Time Warner Cable, you're supporting them. When you buy their groceries from their stores, you're supporting them. When you go into their Whole Foods market that Mackey created, you're supporting them, because the last thing in the world I would call a health food store would be a Whole Foods store, theirs. When you go into their military, you're supporting them. When you vote for any Democrat or Republican currently in competition at the national level, you're supporting them. So how do we figure, since we're eating their food, wearing their clothes, driving their cars, flying on their planes, attending their universities, and banking with them, using their energy, how do we figure that there's 1% and 99%? There's 100%. But it doesn't work that way either. It works this way. We don't have anything that's a complete description of everything. We have economies. For example, you have about 1,600 plus billionaires, and they get the attention. So if you want to say they are the 1/100th of a percent in wealth and power, you could. But then what about all the people who aren't billionaires but have between 500 million and a billion? Then what about the people who have 100 million to 500 million? Then what about the people who have $1 million to 10 million? That's 8 million people. 8 million. Now, with those 8 million, a lot of them are entrepreneurs. I do not challenge how they made their money. Most are ethical, hardworking people, but they've got 4 people average per family, according to consensus. That's 32 million. So 32 million is 10% of the American population. But can you fault them? Are all of them greedy? Are all of them equally culpable? Absolutely not. Then behind them, you have your professional class, lawyers, doctors, professors, consultants, lobbyists, CPAs, many successful artists like Steven Spielberg. And they represent 7 million people. All right? 7 million times 4 is 28 million. So now you got 28 million and you have 32 million. Now you're at 60 million people. Then you have frugal, more conservative savers, people living in gated communities. And they're about 20 million. And you have 4, which is 80 million. So if you take the frugal, conservative savers who made their money honorably, as far as I know, the ones I've spoken to have, who are trying to live ethical lives as best they can, they certainly are not the enemy. Well, add them into the professional class. Many people in the professional class are honorable people. They took their time, they paid their dues, they went to school. Some are not. But you're still dealing with 140 million people between just those groups of individuals. So that represents 40% of the American population. And then you have your bureaucracies, federal bureaucracy, state bureaucracy, and local bureaucracies. You have your people who have seniority at work. You have your working union members. Now, if you take your working union members, your seniority employees, and the other people, you have about 110 million people. These are people who work, they earn a living, they're not rich, they'll never be rich, but there are about 110 million of them. Then you take your part-time workers, your underworking people, you're overworked because you're underpaid, so you might have to hold 2 jobs in the service industries. You have an education frequently that has nothing to do with the work you're doing. And so these are the people called the poor working class. Interesting, because they're frequently criticized for whatever benefits socially they're given, and yet these people are working. They're not looking for a handout from anyone. They would like to be paid what is a humane living wage and get the benefit from that, but they're not. They have to fight for everything. So you're dealing with a lot of people in that group. Plus you have your unemployed. And your unemployed who stopped working, and they're at the bottom rung. And then you have something that no one counts. Anywhere from 60 to 70 million of our young people from 1 year to 18 years of age. And they're not the backbone of the workforce. So you exclude them from 321 million, and you get 251 million people. All right? Out of the 251 million, then you have to subtract the groups that are working but are not at an advantage. They're just able to make ends meet but generally have more bills than they have their income. They have more debt on their – they're having to pay for their kids' colleges, their credit cards, their mortgages, late fees. And then you start to see those people, the working poor, the service personnel, and the seniors. They're the ones going getting payday loans, paying anywhere from 50 to 1,000% interest, and they stay in perpetual debt peonage and can go to debtors' prisons. So when we talk about 1% and 99%, what we do is a gross injustice to the people who have earned their right to a living and what they have, and those who are working their hardest and can't get above it because the system itself works against them. It exploits their poverty. It exploits their inability to find the work that they're qualified for or trained for. So we don't have an economy. We have multiple economies. And people benefit or are limited based upon the impact of others. So if you excluded the 1,600 billionaires and excluded everyone making over $10 million, you're excluding about somewhere in the neighborhood of about 6% of the American population. And those are mainly many of the policymakers. But then you also have to deal with your lawyers, your politicians, your professional class, who are the technocrats, who are the policy wonks, who also make policies that benefit the richest. So you see, it gets a little more complex. I just wish that we began to think of the truth of things instead of accepting superficial, inaccurate, and in my opinion, grossly flawed concepts, and then give ourselves a pat on the back and walk away that we're the 99%, the good people, and that 1% are the really evil people. Yeah, there are a lot of bad people in power. I mean, a lot of bad. But they're not just the 1,600 billionaires. I'm Gary Nall, and let's say hello to Chris from Queens. Hi, Chris, your turn.
Hi, Gary. I'm very glad that you, I didn't call for this, but I'm very glad that you're discussing this about the 99%. I said that well over a year ago with a friend of mine. We were discussing it, and I thought, you know, there's something missing in between here. And I think it's a topic that needs to be, doted on and discussed further, because a lot of people out here, really are really in the middle, and I don't think the consideration for their lives is taken, is considered at all. I wanted to comment very briefly when you're talking about the declassified report regarding ISIL. It was very apparent to me when they came out with ISIL, a little over a year ago, when they started to say these are the worst murderers or even worse than Al-Qaeda, and it just didn't seem real to me. The more recent development, I don't know if you're aware, I heard yesterday that Lavrov and the Russian delegation is going to meet with the so-called Syrian opposition, and they're going to discuss, how they can resolve this in a more have a political resolution. It was very obvious that whatever is happening, at least to me and some other people that I talk with, their aim initially was to get Assad dethroned. That's why this started even 3 years ago when all this trouble started. I firmly believe, my opinion, I don't think that this civil war in Syria would have ever taken place. I'm not including the other countries. I really don't. I don't think that Syria, even Assad as a ruler and the people who live there, I mean, I've never been to Syria, but Assad was not one of your worst rulers within the region. He happened to have been very, his government at least, was very supportive and protective of minorities within Syria. This is very well known, okay, and I'm talking religious minorities. And so I don't know why. I know that the Turks and Turkey and the Saudis can't stand him and they want him out. And it's very evident that, I mean, it was in the European press well over a year ago that a lot of these weapons and the trained mercenaries who were going into Syria, the so-called opposition before the ISIL thing, was they were going in through southern Turkey. Okay, this was well known. It was reported in the European press. The American press doesn't pick it up here. And even if they knew it, if they were aware of it, they wouldn't report it because Turkey doesn't fall in that category. So, I mean, essentially what they've done here, this is a deep war crime, because if you look at what's going on now in the Mediterranean with these refugees on the island, there are several islands in Greece that have absolutely been taken over, you know, the Syrian refugees, by Syrian refugees. You have Italy in the south and the Greeks, the Greece, right? They have to deal with all of this, and now the northern European countries, I heard before that even Germany is considering building fences and borders because it's getting out of control. So look at what they've created. They went in there and they created this multitude of people with their children, okay, leaving a country that they've devastated because of their own interests there. And that includes Turkey, by the way. It's not just the United States with the Kurds there and that whole region there. It's a lot of really evil things. It's a word that I avoid using when I talk about things, but it's an evil thing that took place. And when you consider what they've done globally now, okay, if you look at Greece's recent problems, okay, and they were actually criticized by the United Nations on one of this island because it was several thousand. I mean, we're talking about thousands of people on this small island, and they don't have enough personnel to take care of them. And these people said they don't want to stay there. They wanted to go to Europa, Northern Europe, meaning Germany and France, who are now setting up borders. So when you look at these criminal, this criminal cartel, because that's what it is, I get so outraged when I look at it because, you know, we in the United States have the luxury of living here. And so much commentary that you hear comes out of a book. They never stop to think and look at the faces and wonder, gee, you know what? How would I like it if I had to travel on a dinghy to get to another country because I've just been thrown out of my country because of the war taking place? You know, so anyway, I just wanted to make a couple of those comments. And the fact that the Russians are now considering talking to the opposition because my view is that because of this problem with the Kurds, which there's a, you know, it started with Turkey and the Kurds that they're bombing. They're afraid that this is going to escalate, and it makes it serious because Turkey is involved. So now that they're going to talk to them. So I just wanted to throw in a couple of pennies regarding that, and thank you.
I appreciate it. I was just informed also that we had some technical issues. I'm not sure why. And we'll troubleshoot and try to find those before our next program. So evidently at some point during the program, some of my broadcast was not heard, and we'll get it fixed, whatever it is. I'm on the road. I'm in the last day of a retreat here for this week, one more to go, to help our wonderful station WBAI and its members, and I want to thank you. This has been spectacular. I'll let you know some of the outcomes, and especially I'm going to have on someone next week, at the end of the week, who has made a wonderful journey in her being able to use nature and determination in reversing a life-challenging condition. I think you'll find her story important. And your comments about Syria intervention, the stupidity of it, and the fact that now we find out the truth, but we always find out the truth in America after the fact. And that is unfortunate. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.